Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, I went red wine. Again, I think that's 2 weeks from now. No, last week was white wine.
Yes, you went with a Pinot Noir called Prophecy, which my best guess would be that that's related to It. Oh, and it's got sort of a clown-ish looking label, so definitely a little penny wiser.
You're about, you're correct on the connection. I got it because of the clown slash minstrel. But then I realized it's called Prophecy, mm-hmm. And the prophecy is every 27 years, Pennywise is coming back to kill your kids. Not your kids, but if you live in Derry, Maine, he's coming to kill your kids. But apparently you won't really care because there are no adults, really, or parents that are running around town screaming that their kids are murdered.
Yeah, I noticed that there doesn't seem to be much of an uproar by any parental units.
I think in the book it explains it away, but
book's 1,138 pages, so I suspect there's more in the book than we saw in the movie.
But we're back. In 2017, Pennywise popped up Bill Skarsgård and a very convincing-looking evil clown motif, and he challenged the Losers Club. He challenged seven children who came together from different parts of town, formed a band, if you will, formed a clan, confronted the clown, and won! They won! Spoilers, 2017. And then they all got older. They really hit puberty, they went their separate ways. One stayed behind, Mike. And it's happening again. Children are dying, people are dying. Come back. We made a promise, we made a solemn oath, we even scarred our palms. Come back. They don't remember. Like, I know something bad to me. Something bad happened to me 27 years ago in Derry, Maine, but I don't remember what it was. So, naturally, the next day, they all show up anyway.
You are just a run-on train here.
No, because I want to...
Does anyone know what movie we're even talking about yet?
I'm leading... Well, we said It and Pennywise already, but I'm leading to... You didn't like... Because I just want to start... I want to start with the cold open. Just the cold open, which you did not like. And it really, I think it set the tone for the film. I think it takes place in present day, like 2019, in fact. You got all these recognizable A-list stars. And in the first scene, there's this really heinous, vicious hate crime. And it really sets the scene of, this is Derry, Maine, this is what it's like, these are the townspeople, and there's that clown again. And it just turned you the hell off, I believe.
Well, it's not that it turned me off, it's that it was, it didn't track for the rest of the movie for me. Like, you saw it as sort of this setup to Derry, Maine being sort of this backwards kind of town still, and to me it set up, I was like, oh my gosh, this is going to be really just brutal to watch. Not horror film grotesque, but more like horrific drama brutal. And fortunately that's really not where it goes. And so to me, it didn't track with the tone of the rest of the movie. So I just didn't quite see why we were getting that scene. So you made a connection that I just sort of was probably averting my eyes at the time. And I just thought it didn't match the kind of horror and psychological horror that becomes the staple of this particular film and this particular sequel.
2 years ago, we knew there had to be a sequel because it became the highest grossing horror film of all time. Not even just of Stephen King adaptations, of all time, of all the Conjurings and everything. It made the most money. So people were playing a game. Who will play the adult versions of these kids? People like, oh, the girl has to be Jessica Chastain. Please be Jessica Chastain. Mm-hmm. And she said, all right, I'll do it. And the ones I thought were the most effective was her. She is very similar. And the hypochondriac Eddie. he's played by James Ransone. They are very, very similar. And Bill Hader as Trash Mouth Richie.
He was awesome. Bill Hader, to me, was the biggest scene-stealing surprise of It Chapter 2.
And he looks like little Richie, played by Finn Wolfhard from Stranger Things. What I think they just did, because they needed another A-lister or A-minuser, was James McAvoy. James McAvoy shows up as Bill. They don't really look alike, but they needed the natural leader of the Losers Club. And he kind of is, out of all those people, I think he's billed first, just because I think he's in the movie the most. What do you think of James McAvoy?
I like James McAvoy, so I just enjoy watching him. He's so incredibly talented and can play just about anything. So for me, I was okay with that. I think that, the film did a good job of intercutting the original younger actors into the film so that you'd see the mannerisms and the physical traits and the emotional traits that equate help you equate the younger actors with the adults that are portraying them 27 years later. And so for me, having, you know, being able to sort of see the back and forth a little bit, it helped sell James McAvoy a little bit more. So whether or not he embodies the character to the same degree that like Jessica Chastain was like so obviously Beverly, I think James McAvoy's in it because he's just a good talent and can kind of pull off anything.
You mentioned interweaving the stories, and Chapter 2, does not stand on its own. You cannot watch it first before it. Like, you can watch The Conjuring 2 without having seen The Conjuring. Yes, some characters overlap, but it doesn't matter. They're both authentic, separate stories. Not it. Same exact characters, even though they're played by different cast. Same storyline. It does not, and some sequels are like that, and it's a risk. They do not stand on their own. You cannot just jump in. Andy Muschietti is back as director. He obtained prominence first with a horror film called Mama, starring Jessica Chastain. I thought it was okay. That was pretty good. It's actually very similar now to The Curse of La Llorona, another Conjuring realm franchise entry. This one, however, I'm going to say Chapter 2 is less than. If you have to compare and contrast, it's less than the first. I still love how he murders children. It's the most effective part of the film. There are two key scenes where everything else is off screen. It's just the clown and the child. You're like a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old, and it's just mano y mano. It's built up, the suspense, the thrills, the cinematography, the filmmaking. It's gorgeous, it's beautiful, and then a child is murdered. it's really the best part of the film.
Okay.
I'm serious.
To me, the best part of the film, and there's not enough of it, is when all the losers are actually together interacting in the same room. The nature of the plot is such that they are kind of sent their separate ways periodically throughout this film in order to kind of collect an artifact from their past in revisiting their battle with Pennywise. But I thought, to me, it's when the movie became its most entertaining and sort of a deep breath or an exhalation of breath when they're together and just having just sort of playing off of each other a little bit more. And so the child snatching and feeding off the children of Derry is the psychological and literal horror of this horror movie, but it's the other stuff that makes this a little more tolerable for a non-horror person like me to watch. I went back and I read my review of It from 2 years ago, and I had really enjoyed it. I was shocked at how much I did enjoy it, and I knew that there would be a sequel, and I think they set the sequel up at the end. I believe they did their little blood oath at the end of the first It, and so they certainly left the door open to come storming back for the sequel. But I agree, this is not, if you didn't see the first one because it didn't appeal to you at all to see It 2 years ago, you definitely are not going to want to see It Chapter 2. If you saw It and kind of vaguely remember, but you know, are worried that you would need some sort of refresher, I do think that the flashbacks and the inner cutting will be enough to just sort of provide the refresher for those who did see the original. And certainly anyone who actually managed to trudge through an 1,100-page novel from Stephen King, and I think it's his second longest book, then you're probably going to actually be missing some certain things that are in the book that apparently did not make the cut for this movie that is already 2 hours and 49 minutes long.
The film was too long.
It was too
long.
It's
45 minutes too long.
At least 40.
The reason it's so long is because it's not really about the Losers Club. They split up the club. They have there's six of them, and they have to do their six respective journeys, their adventures. And he goes through all six, and some are much stronger than others. Beverly's probably being the strongest with her run-in with a very creepy old woman, which is a great scene. Mm-hmm. Some are less strong. Eddie in the pharmacy. Bill Hader in the arcade. It's filler. It doesn't need to be there. It's just way too long. They could have just alluded to it. Yeah, I had a journey too. It just wasn't working for me, which is why this is a full star lower for me. I loved the first. I also went back and read my review, and I gushed. I was 3.5 stars on it. That was a wonderful film. And of course, if you saw the first one, you're going to want to wrap this up.
Right.
Bill Skarsgård as Pennywise is just as good.
Yes.
He's on screen more, which I think is actually less. You know, he's on screen right. more, so he's actually less scary this time.
Yeah, I think he was a little less scary to me this time because the first one just...
Good Lord.
Yeah, it just freaked you out.
The first scene from It was him in the sewer, you can kind of see him, and Georgie in the yellow slicker. That's an infamous scene now. It's in lore.
I had a much more visceral and emotional response watching the first It. This one, you kind of knew where it would have to end up ultimately. Sort of, unless you felt like there might be a It Chapter 3 in 27 years. In 2043, we might be sitting back here going, you know, oh my gosh, Pennywise somehow is back.
Do you remember the first one? I don't think we saw it.
That's right. We'll be watching it on some new device. But so I don't know. But I do feel that no harm, no foul. You kind of have to, if you saw It and enjoyed It, It Chapter 2 is a means to an end, and it's a fairly satisfying end, even though it just takes way too long to get there.
Well, schedule wisely, because it's long, and you're going to be there for a while, and you're going to have previews in your theater.
Pee before you go.
Yeah, very good. Very good. All right, our second film is a reminder of 2003. In 2019, director Gavin Hood is still very mad. He's more than mad. He's seething with anger still about 2003 and the run-up to the Iraq War, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and how that unspooled. He never forgot Colin Powell at the United Nations and the Coalition of the Willing. But this is not from the American side. It's from the Brits. We forget that our staunchest ally back then was also our staunchest go-to-war. Let's invade Iraq. It was Tony Blair. And this is actually a movie that is very anti, very mad, very finger-pointy Tony Blair and his government, and abuse of power, and lies, and one woman who does something about it. Her moral compass is compromised, her guilty conscience, Jiminy Cricket, springs to life. Hannah, who, what actress am I talking about, and what does she do?
Well, we get to see Keira Knightley in, like, modern-day attire, which is just shocking to me.
Yeah, she's an 1800s girl.
So unless 2003 is considered a period piece, it's nice to see Keira in something a little more modern. So in this movie, Official Secrets, she plays a British translator who works for basically Britain's equivalent of the NSA, the woman's name is Catherine Gunn, and this is a real story, and she's a real person. And so this film is based on a book called The Spy Who Tried to Stop a War, Catherine Gunn and the Secret Plot to Sanction the Iraq Invasion.
You forgot the colon.
That is a long title. The Spy Who Tried to Stop a War, colon.
Thank you.
Catherine Gunn and the Secret Plot to Sanction the Iraq Invasion. And so Keira Knightley kind of carries this movie because there's really...
She's never seen.
It's just, there's a reason that I think we probably didn't see a movie beforehand about this woman who is a whistleblower, and she took extreme chances, you know, made a lot of personal and professional sacrifices to sort of blow the lid off of an NSA attempt to use British intelligence to help them strong arm smaller nations in the UN Security Council to back a war resolution against Iraq. And Catherine Gunn gets her hands on this email from an NSA person, and she's just like, this is wrong. They're trying to, you know, sort of blackmail, bribe these smaller countries into supporting an unjust war. And so she ends up leaking the email to an anti-war activist, who then gets it into the hands of a British journalist at The Observer, and sort of her world kind of blows apart at that point. And it didn't matter. I think the hardest, the saddest part of this whole story is here's somebody who totally recognized the false narrative that the U.S. was putting forth, Colin Powell was putting forth on behalf of George W. at the time, falsely connecting Saddam Hussein to weapons of mass destruction and to Al-Qaeda. And so this woman, Catherine Gunn, was like, whoa, 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 you know, wait a second. We can't be complicit in this effort. And so it's about her attempt to sort of stop this unjust war. But in the end, she's only one person. It didn't really gain enough traction. The train was out of the station. And in the end, she gets charged with a crime, with violating Britain's Official Secrets Act, which basically was like, we're allowed to lie to the people as long as we can claim national security.
Her defense attorney is played by Rafe Fiennes, who, you know, plays it straight, doesn't have much to do, but, ooh, very respected, Rafe Fiennes.
I love Rafe Fiennes, and he doesn't come into this movie until about an hour in, and so, you know, it kind of picked up a little bit for me once he entered the picture because he's Rafe Fiennes.
The funnest person to watch on screen, who really hams it up, but is on screen for a very limited amount of time, is Rhys Ifans. Mm-hmm. He is the DC correspondent for the London Observer, the newspaper that publishes Catherine's story. And man, he really gets his diatribes. He gets his speeches and, you know, screaming into the telephone about everything that's wrong with the world. And it's actually really fun to watch. And it's probably good they limited his time because it felt punchy and quick and I liked it.
That's what he does. He's like that good little character actor that pops up. I loved him in Notting Hill. He's like the roommate in Notting Hill. And so that to me was one of my favorite roles for him.
I noticed Official Secrets is IFC Films. We saw another IFC Films, movie a couple months ago called Red Joan. They're typecasting themselves. Red Joan was about a female in a man's world, sort of, who took it upon herself to do something. She didn't like what was happening, so she went ahead and did something to sort of change the world, at least change the dialogue, change the conversation. And they both thought, and her and Catherine, Joan and Catherine, are very, very similar characters. And these are somewhat very similar films. I like Official Secrets better than Red Joan. Actually, Kira should have been a Red Joan because it was a period movie somewhat. That was way back in the 40s. Official Secrets will be forgotten. It's going to be a very small movie. Maybe it will be bigger on the other side of the pond. Kira usually is known as one of the Globe's better actresses. I don't believe she'll achieve enough notoriety here to achieve any sort of nomination. But if you're a political science major like me, you will enjoy the themes in this film about, you know, one woman against the system. Does government have a right to lie to its people? What do you do when you encounter a vindictive government? These are poli-sci issues. Will those issues appeal to a mainstream mass audience? Probably not.
Well, and as a journalism major, this will also appeal to the journalism folks who have to sort of balance sometimes what they are being fed, the official lines that they are being fed, with reporting and digging and investigating and exposing. And so this, you know, the problem with this film is it's kind of dry. It just kind of plods along. There aren't any really dramatic spikes. They're trying to use the music to turn it into some sort of, to bring some tension where there just wasn't enough. And it took her like 8 months before the government even indicted Catherine Gunn for on charges relating to the Official Secrets Act. But it's not the most exciting story, but it is interesting, and it certainly slipped through the cracks of what people know about. You know, people know when you think whistleblowers and security, you're thinking Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, and so, you know, Chelsea Manning. So this one is like it makes you sort of think, where does she fall and did they fall?
She's 201% more sympathetic,
absolutely,
than Edward Snowden and Julian Assange.
No, absolutely. She's definitely more sympathetic. There's no denying the point of view that this film is taking. And I mean, I love, you know, Gavin Hood directed one of my favorite movies, Eye in the Sky.
One that was thrilling.
It was thrilling. It was tense. It was edge of your seat. And so this one is not that. It's just an interesting story. It tries to be a little bit All the President's Men light or The Post light. You know, it just from the journalism perspective, you know, it's about I think
they even mentioned the Pentagon Papers.
They mentioned the Pentagon Papers. The Reese character mentions at some point, you know, that we're not Tony Blair's PR agency, and we're not here to just put out the government press releases. And so I feel sometimes that for a while there, journalism kind of fell into that trap. And I remember back in the covering the 2001 to 2003 goings on, and how you did feel that if you didn't just sort of repeat what the Pentagon and the State Department and the White House told you to repeat, that you were somehow being, you know, not being patriotic or you were being disloyal. And so this film does, it will get sort of your blood boiling again a little bit if you already are still kind of ticked off about whether we should have gone to war in the first place against Iraq. And so it's interesting. It's just not very compelling.
Yeah, Gavin Hood is one of those bounce back and forth directors. He makes a movie he really wants to make, which is usually political. And then he makes a blockbuster to make a whole bunch of money that his last movie didn't make. And then he'll go back. So he made Rendition, Reese Witherspoon, I believe it was. He made Eye in the Sky. Now he made Official Secrets. Very three political films. But then in between those, he made X-Men Origins, Wolverine, terrible film, a terrible X-Men film, and he made the adaptation of Ender's Game. So he knows where his bread and butter is, so he does it on, it's like Nicolas Cage. I'm going to make this blockbuster like Con Air, so I can make these 29 other movies I really want to make.
Yeah, and I mean, if you didn't have Keira Knightley and Ralph Fiennes in this, it would just be...
We wouldn't have seen it.
It would never have made our radar. And so, you know, it's I think it's one of those interesting ones that can wait until it's streaming. I don't think anyone needs to run out and find it.
All right, you squeezed in a third film this week, very sneaky like, very on the sly. What did you see?
On the sly, yeah. I sent it to you and I said, you really should watch this perhaps.
And I said, no, I got anything else to do.
And you said you had other things to do, and it's a shame because I'm watching it going, it's a Charlie movie.
I'll stop it.
So it's called Before You Know It, and it's a quirky indie. Mm. And nothing screams Charlie more than a quirky indie.
Well, I saw that Judith Light was in it, and I'm pretty sure nothing screams like Judith Light.
Well, but Judith Light is playing, first of all, she's got Emmys and a Tony and
Tony
and
Danza.
She's theater, yeah, for Who's the Boss. No, actually, I think her Emmys came from soap operas. And so here she is playing this sort of veteran soap star within this film. But basically, it's a passion project, you can tell. It was one of these films. It was it's the feature directorial debut for a woman named Hannah Pearl Utt. And so Hannah's name's all over this, which is another reason I probably was sort of primed to watch it. But she co-wrote and co-stars with Jen Tulloch. And they are both like real-life theater geek friends. And they wrote this together. And they play these codependent sisters in a very dysfunctional family relationship. And they live with their father who in a above a theater in Greenwich Village that they own. And the father is this eccentric playwright played by Mandy Patinkin. So, you know, this cast, you've got Mandy Patinkin in there. You also have Alec Baldwin shows up as a psychiatrist. And who else? Tim Daly pops up in a cameo. So, I mean, she got some fun people to just kind of pop in and help her on this film. And it really is where the quirky and where the Judith Light character comes in, is that these two sisters discover when their father dies that there's a co-owner on the deed to this theater that they live in and that they want to preserve. And that co-owner is this woman who is a soap opera star. And so they're like, wait a minute, who is this person? And so it's not a spoiler. It's really integral to the plot. They discover this is the mother that their father had told them years and years and years ago had died. So they had long, the mother was long presumed dead. And here, when they go to, when they discover stuff out in their father's will and are sort of sorting out his debt-ridden finances, they discover that their mother is alive and well and thriving as this very melodramatic soap actress. And they track her down, and the story sort of goes from there. And it's a strange little film. And it's about their individual, the individual journeys of these sisters and what happens when they confront. And they don't really confront the mother in any major way. It's just sort of accepted. It's kind of like, hey, by the way, we're your daughters. And they're like, oh, that's interesting. And they get, you know, kind of chummy. But that's really not not where the movie goes for any length of time. It then just sort of delves in and out of the relationship between these sisters. And one sister is very flighty, and she's a single mother, and she's got a teenage daughter. And I'll tell you, the one interesting, really interesting person to kind of keep an eye out is this girl, Una Yaffe. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but she's making her feature film debut here as the 12-year-old daughter, Dodge, who is, of course, the sanest of the bunch, you know, living with this, in the midst of this dysfunctional family. And she is one to watch in the future because she was really very, she's kind of a compelling watch. She's very good. And apparently she's also a very good chef because she was a contestant on season 2 of MasterChef Junior. So with a name like Una, O-O-N-A, hopefully we'll spot her again in the future if she pops up in other things. But again, this is, you know, this is just one of those small films. Ut and Tulloch, they're best known for some for a series called Disengaged that I was not familiar with. But that's where they've worked together before. So this is just, if you like quirk and the melodrama is intentional with the soap opera stuff. So Judith Light is actually a good choice for that particular role. But these are some strange characters. And I just, you know, it just kind of plods along. I didn't love it, but I could understand why these theater people would all kind of gravitate toward participating in it. And for Hannah Ut, it definitely is, it's her baby all the way through.
Meh.
Yeah, no, but I do think it's more your speed. And so you know, some people, I saw a really decent review of it today in the Washington Post, and I was kind of surprised at how favorable the review actually was. But then I thought, you know what, it's if you embrace the quirk, then you're going to embrace this film. So, it's very hard for anyone even to remember what it's called.
Well, one film we did not see this week, which is, it's in very limited release moving around the country, is called Vita and Virginia. Virginia being Virginia Woolf, by the way. And I noticed, I saw it online when she posted it, Artie Chick has a wonderful one of those spot log lines of her review. Please read us Artie Chick of chickflix.net's review of this.
Yeah, so you can go to chickflix.net to actually read her entire review. But her, she says that to her, Vita and Virginia, quote, feels like a lost lesbian episode of Downton Abbey. So she says they're good performances, gorgeous sets and costumes, but you can wait for it on a streaming service.
Well, it's got that feel that we just saw Wild Nights with Emily, with Molly Shannon playing Emily Dickinson. This stars Gemma Arterton. I love Gemma Arterton. She's honestly one of my favorite actresses. Just, you know what? There's only so many hours in that day.
Right, and that's actually a good parallel because it's this scandalous decade-long relationship between Virginia Woolf and this British socialite named Vita. And I guess apparently, though, that this relationship led to one of Woolf's greatest books, Orlando, and which itself was turned into a movie with Tilda Swinton. And so Artie Chick also refers to Orlando as being probably the better film to watch.
All right, what are you looking at next week? I know there's another movie that someone made a book out of.
I'm like, which one is that? I didn't read it, but yes, The Goldfinch.
Won the Pulitzer.
And I believe, does that have Ansel Elgort in it?
I have no idea.
I don't know. And I think Nicole Kidman. So that one looks like our drama du jour. And then Hustlers.
I asked that's you like if we were going to that.
Jennifer Lopez, maybe? Was she in? I don't know.
It's yeah, like, J-Lo's in it. And I actually got the feeling, I don't know, it reminded me of The Kitchen.
I know. The Kitchen and a strip club or something, I think. So maybe it's The Strip Club instead of The Kitchen. But that's a big fear of mine, that it does look a little too close to that. But we'll drag ourselves to Hustlers just because it's potentially one. Really, the only big movies coming out next week would be Hustlers and The Goldfinch. But we've got quite a few really strong documentaries coming down the pike.
Ooh la la.
And so among those we can talk about next week, Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice, which I saw at AFI Docs. Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins.
That was the closing film.
The closing film. I also saw at AFI Docs, and it just makes you wish that Molly Ivins were still alive, because she would just be having a field day with our world right now. And Fiddler, A Miracle of Miracles, a documentary about Fiddler on the Roof, which actually we were initially going to talk about this week, but its release was pushed back a week in D.C.
That's a lot of documentaries.
So we can just sort of run through the music-related documentaries and the political-related documentaries next week.
Well, a very quick recap of what we talked about this week. It, no colon, Chapter 2. I really like watching The Clown. He's good. And I know it sounds terrible, but the filmmaking of Murdered Children is actually above average. It's nowhere near as good as the first film.
It's not as good as the first film, but I really enjoyed watching Bill Hader as like this snarky guy who grew up to be a stand-up comic and sort of channel his childhood pain into his adult character as a comic. And so that to me was one of the most surprising things. And we failed to mention that the guy who played the biggest transformative character from childhood to adult would be that the chubby kid from the first It is Ben. Now hot.
Ben is now hot.
So Ben is now hot. So he's a much better, he's a different kind of good looking guy.
I don't know how much about that I believe.
I know, but hey. So It's Chapter 2 is not as good as It 1, but is still worth seeing to sort of just get some closure.
Official Secrets is the smart person movie of the week. There's nothing to say don't go,
right.
But I'm really find it hard to say go.
Exactly. It was an interesting story that I was not aware of that just sort of really makes you think about where you draw the line when your conscience, how you can make sacrifices to do the right thing and not get reamed for it, and whether or not we can really do that in our current climate.
And the other one
that I have to keep looking it up, because it is not a name that rolls off the tongue. It is Before You Know It, and it is the quirky indie pick of the week.
It's a very forgettable title. It really is.
Yes,
it's not
it
your
is.
Fault.
It does not help.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.